This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Can we start by saying hello to Dom Jolly? Simply because he turns up on Twitter all the time, and every now and then he mentions the show. And I realise that we've never said thank you. I realise that we've never said hello to Dom Jolly, or at least not recently anyway.
Why did you just say thank you halfway through
that as in the speech? Because in the middle of the sentence, as the people who are watching online will know, David, who's David? Regular listeners know who David is, came in and gave me a list, which I had asked him for, and I said thank you, because I find it impossible to take something off somebody without saying thank you.
Barry from York, good afternoon, Argos, and other generic catalogue companies.
Very good. This is because of Clash of the Titans.
Just because it's Thursday doesn't seem justified as to why the good doctor has dressed down. Can he please explain?
Because it's Thursday, because I'm not going from here to News 24, and because...
The news channel, because News 24 hasn't existed for a while.
Right. Is it going to be like this for the rest of the show?
Well, being accurate and making it clear.
Making it clear, Simon.
Let's use the right terminology wherever appropriate. Mm.
Can we just say, incidentally, on the evidence of the bottom of your shoes on this week, I don't think you have the right to give fashion advice to anybody, frankly.
Actually, on the subject of that film that we did for this week about the party election broadcast.
It was Simon Mayo and Mark Cormond.
Andrew Neil, read the script just ahead of it. Coming up on the auto cue.
No, but the best thing about it was the
Mark Cormond.
The look in his eyes as he went with Simon Ming.
Who are these?
And Mark Cormond. Anyway, they'll be joining us now. Back to Michael Portillo on the sofa.
This is Jeremy. Dear Ziggy Stardust and the Thin White Duke, is it just me or is Mark Strong in everything?
He is in everything.
Robin Hood, Sherlock Holmes, Kick-Ass, Young Victoria, Endgame in recent months, with The Way Back, Eagle of the Ninth and The Guard coming up this year. Is there a group of Mark Strong robots filling top-level supporting parts across the length and breadth of Hollywood? Or does he just not sleep? Not that I'm complaining, he's glorious in everything. And he was on this show very recently. But he is great.
It is remarkable how many things he's in, and yet he doesn't seem to be spreading himself thin. He's got... I know there is a few people about whom I feel this. It's one of those names which, when you see Mark Strong come up in the cast, you go, all right, fine. Whatever happens, there's going to be something which is okay because it's Mark Strong. And then, of course, the worst thing is he came in and he was just lovely, wasn't he? He was just genuinely really nice. And actually, because when you see him on screen, he's a very threatening screen presence. That's the card that he plays quite a lot because he's very good at it. But in fact, in real life...
Thin, weedy and short.
No, I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say smiling, affable and lovely. But thin, weedy and short, you said that, OK?
Jim...
So, Mark, if you're listening, it was Simon who said you were thin, weedy and short and me who said you were sweet, smiling and affable.
We'll come on to the subject of Robin Hood in just a few moments' time. The Russell
Crowe
interview.
Smiling and affable. That'll be Russell Crowe, then.
Russell Crowe coming up just after a 2:15. It's an interview that we did last week, and it's great fun. Actually, it's terrific. We have made it slightly more family-friendly, as you'll hear.
Oh, have we?
Well, you know, it would be inappropriate to use all the language in its all its robustness.
Okay.
As it went through.
But you
so
have,
you can relax if you're listening at home. You know, everything is going to be fine and tickety-boo.
But just to be clear, although the language has been edited for family...
Everything else is in there. In all its glory. Jim in Cheltenham, dear Tyler and Cornelius, it's not easy... trying to see films outside London. He starts rather controversially,
yes.
I think. In Cheltenham, we used to have a lovely Odeon, complete with threadbare carpet, musty smells, baffling staircases and suspicious stains on the pavement outside. The evil world domination, fantasy machinations of insert large corporation cinema chain here, soon put an end to that with their fancy Dan red lights and escalators, £3 bottle of water and searches to prevent you smuggling your own drinks. They didn't show A Serious Man last year. Now they're not showing Agora. If you want to see many, many screens of Iron Man, Date Night, Give Us All Your Money for a Few Brief Bangs, Whistle, Set Pieces, Whoop-de-doo, CGI effects, product placement, grumbly deafening gargles with brick acid bass voice of Robert Downey Jr., orange, tartanized 3D Dayglow kids screeched, oh my goodness, or smiley virus, it would be perfect. Sadly, I'm sane and can only mourn the murder of independent cinema by faceless money machines who know nothing of art, beauty, love or humour. Please tell me, when is it going to end?
Mark? Well, when is it going to end? Well, the day and date revolution, unfortunately, seems to be the way that it's going to... I mean, in the end, I suspect that what's going to happen is that we are going to go day and date with everything, that you're going to get everything released simultaneously on DVD download and in cinemas. And actually, I think it's quite a good thing, because what will happen is the cinemas that will survive will be the cinemas that give you a viewing experience that make you want to go out and watch something properly rather than just sit at home. I mean, as I did refer to before, David... and I went to see the date night, whatever it was called, and it cost us, between the two of us, 26 quid to sit in a pokey little cinema. And I mean, we didn't have drinks or snacks or anything. I mean, we're both, you know, trimming ourselves down. £26. I really didn't feel like we got £26 worth of laughter out of it.
Hannah Arifin Bolton, dear Prime Minister and Leader of the Opposition, What should one do when a flatmate reveals? This is quite an interesting discussion. Hannah has a problem. What should one do when a flatmate reveals that they hate all British films? It's important to note that this flatmate loves all the Saw films and really, honestly believes that He's Just Not That Into You is one of the best rom-coms ever made. She also loves The Day After Tomorrow. I quite like that. I would like Mark to provide me with a definitive list of truly great British-funded funded movies that I can shove in her face.
Oh, hang on. Now, when you say British-funded movies or British movies,
well,
you're going to get into a complicated issue there. I mean, without... I'm going to answer this question, which you've just put before me, but without wishing to swerve it, I think that what we need to do in defining British movies is do what the BFI does, because actually nothing is now... Almost nothing is funded solely by a single country other than some Hollywood movies.
All she wants to say is... Here are British films, and they're great.
Okay.
End of argument. No Fine. Discussion. If you disagree, you're
okay.
a fool.
Matter of Life and Death, The Powell and Pressburger, Ken Russell's The Devils. Obviously, it's funded by Americans, but it's a British movie through and through. Kez, Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Anything in the last, say, decade?
I was working from post-war.
Oh, right, OK. Right, well, we'll be here for a while then.
Trainspotting. I mean, the collected works of the Trainspotting trio. I mean, although, you know, they're made in Scotland, but they're shot down here. Lynn Ramsey's Ratcatcher, and I would also argue Morven Callor. Samantha Morton's Unloved, The Unloved, which was made for television, then briefly in cinemas, just coming out on DVD this week.
Okay.
Where else do you want me to go from here?
Hang on.
Here we go. The Monty Python movies. I mean, en masse. I mean, I would say Monty Python and the Holy Grail, definitely. Monty Python's Life of Brian, I think you'd agree, one of the greatest comedies of all time. Wouldn't you agree?
Which one?
Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Yes, I would.
Holy Grail, you think's funny?
I think Holy Grail is funnier.
Yeah, I mean, all of those.
The smaller the budget, the funnier the film in general.
Yeah, and because big money isn't funny. And as per he likes all... Is it he or she likes all the Saw movies? It must be he, right? He likes all the Saw movies.
Do you know, that's a very, very good question.
I thought you said he likes the Saw movies.
This flatmate loves all the Saw films. She also loves The Day After Tomorrow. 'Tis a woman.
I don't believe it.
Oh, right, OK. Sorry, Hannah, you're lying. Russell Crowe is imminent. A couple of taglines for you. Dear Joe and the Volcano, this is... Occasional Eruptions Only from John.
Also, the entire collective work of Terry Davis. I can't believe I didn't say that.
All those black and white films about Liverpool.
About Liverpool.
So much to look forward to. Obvious tagline for The Last Airbender. It bends air, but there aren't any more of them. Which is very good. In my local view, by the way, says John, they're doing a £3.50 rate for the over 60s. Their ad for this states that the price includes tea and a biscuit. Whilst applauding the idea overall, isn't the last bit just a teeny bit patronising? Punters patronising the cinema, good. The cinema patronising us punters, not so good. I like that.
I'm sorry, I would... £3.60 for a film, a tea and a biscuit and maybe a drive home afterwards, you know. In the car, wrap up warm. It's going to be a bit chilly. Do they have subtitles for the hard of hearing?
We get to Iron Man 2 later. Matthew in Basildon. Dear Mark and Lard, he's a male, he possesses ferrous properties and he's back.
Very good.
Kind of works, doesn't it? It's Five Live, and I'm delighted to say that we have been joined by none other than Russell Crowe, who is speaking to us from a very nice hotel, one imagines, somewhere in London. Hello, Russell. How are you?
Afternoon, gentlemen. How are we?
Now, that is a voice.
Why doesn't my voice sound like that?
I can't do that voice.
All right. It doesn't have to sound like that. It can sound lots of different ways.
Russell, are you suggesting that that's how I talk?
No, it's just making you feel more at home.
All right, then.
I was giving you an accent you might, you know, feel in touch with.
That's very good. That's a bit like Phil Collins, that was.
Is it?
Artful Dodger.
Really? That's not like Phil Collins.
Being the Artful Dodger a few years back.
Yeah, all right.
Russell, we were just trying to work out... I've never interviewed you before. Mark has interviewed you twice, once for The Insider and once for Romper Stomper.
Yeah, the very first time we met.
Really?
Romper Stomper. Yeah, all those years ago.
Cool.
And nothing since then. But we're not promoting Romper Stumper. Oh, no. We're talking Robin Hood. And let's start at the beginning. And the reason why, because it's presumably a brave venture, not to go back in with Sir Ridley, but just to tackle a story that everyone knows and everyone has seen before. You were clearly engaged and wanted to do a slightly different version.
Well, you know, Robin Hood was a part of my childhood. You know, the Richard Green TV series, yeah. The Douglas Fairbanks movie, the Errol Flynn movie, the Richard Todd movie, and the many variations of it, you know, the Disney cartoon, and all the way through to the Mel Brooks version, you know. But once you get to the Mel Brooks version...
I'd forgotten about that
Men in Tights.
Yeah, well, yeah. Something's gone wrong then. If you get to the point where the filmmakers over a period of 100 years of cinema have been using the same touchstones in a narrative, if you get to that point where Mel Brooks is going, right, that's, you know, that's enough, I'll shut this down, then I think you have to clean the slate and start again. You have to find a different way of telling the story. And ultimately, when I started to think about all the various films and rewatch them, they were unsatisfying to me because you didn't really know who this guy was. So much of what he does is just assumed. The filmmaker goes, oh, you know the story, right? You know he's got this, you know, charitable streak inside him, and we'll just play it out from there. You know, we'll just give you what you want, you know. So Robin and Little John meet. They're going to be on a log. They'll have a stave fight. At some point in time, Robin will put on a costume and enter an archery competition. Marion will be captured. She's a damsel in distress requiring saving. You know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I was expecting all of that.
Yeah, well, you're not going to find it in this movie. You know, in this movie, we look at the historical times. We make a time shift that is definitively logical. And that is that King Richard never returned to England. He was killed in historical fact in a field in France, putting a minor French castle to siege, shot in the throat with a crossbow bolt from a French cook. And we begin our movie that way. So straight away, if you're expecting the clichés of Robin Hood that have come to the fore in the 100 years of cinema, you know you're not going to get them, because the guy that's supposed to ride in at the end of the day, he's just copped it in the neck. So that's kind of Ridley's way of hitting that power chord, saying, this isn't the Robin Hood of your grandfather, this isn't the Robin Hood of your mum and dad, this is a completely different take. When we started looking through the process of the story and how it's changed and morphed, you know, the mythology, the legend, when it became a political tool, a tool of the church, a parlor game. And the core thing, the thing that drove us both, is that this story has survived a long time and has been told and retold. Why? What is the compelling thing about Robin Hood? At the central core of Robin Hood is the idea of robbing from the rich to give to the poor, that there is somebody out there, no matter how pear-shaped your world gets, there's somebody out there who's willing to stand up and redress the balance.
And also, it's worth putting a bit of other political context. So you're talking about a historical time shift, but the Magna Carta, that whole aspect of the King John story works its way. I don't want to give everything away, because part of the fun is seeing what you do with this story, but the Magna Carta is part of this story as well, isn't it?
Well, when we started to spread the history in front of us and say, well, where's the fertile ground, really, in English history? Where would this rebel leader, Renaissance fighter, this man of the people, where would he actually grow? What, you know? So during the course of Richard's reign, and remember, you know, Richard, this most beloved hero of English history, was a Frenchman who only spoke French, refused, in fact, publicly to learn to speak English because it was a lesser language, spent 6 months of his 10-year reign here, tried to sell the city of London at one point and was quite peeved he couldn't get a buyer. How is this guy remembered as he is?
But apart from that, he was a good guy.
So, you know, and that's my question to Ridley, is, well, why do people care about him? And when you look into it, it's like, oh, well, you know, he was basically an assassin for the Pope for 10 years. And, you know, as the Catholic Church came back into power, his contribution to English society is rewritten, and John, who was anti-papist, is written down. Another unfortunate thing for poor old Johnny is that he essentially invented taxation. You are never going to be remembered nicely and kindly for that. You know, that's kind of like one of those zero-sum game ideas. Yeah, all your mates in the Chancellery like it, but, mate, you're not going to
not going to get a lot of takers and followers on the streets with that one.
Can you tell us something about working with Ridley Scott? Because you worked with him.
Let me just sort of dance back through that Magna Carta thing.
Carry on.
Because when we got to that point where we're sifting, I was quite surprised because of the negativity that John is remembered with, that he was the guy that signed the first version of the Magna Carta. And simultaneously, which is not something that I could find in regular research, but in a conversation with Billy Bragg, I was telling him, look, this is my idea, you know, this is what we're working at. We're actually trying to push Robin Hood towards the Magna Carta, you know. And Billy said, well, and the Forest Charter. And I'm, what are you talking about? He said, well, you know, let me send you a link.
Wow.
So he sent me a link, and simultaneous to the Magna Carta, which really deals with the relationships between barons and kings, is this thing called the Forest Charter, which re-established the rights of men. So for a long time thereafter, Henry put in place these laws. You couldn't hunt in the forest, you couldn't forage in the forest, you couldn't pick up found objects. But the Forest Charter readdresses that. So you are, as an individual, able, you know, given certain rules, to fend for yourself if you want to, you know. Under Henry's rule, it was basically you had to attach yourself to one of the big houses and be a serf kind of thing, otherwise you couldn't survive. So that was very interesting, that there was this simultaneous thing called the Forest Charter. So that's what I said to Ridley at that point, is like, here it is, mate, here it is, that Richard dies, you know, say a guy comes back to England, who hasn't been to England since he was a kid, you know, and he's worldly, he has marched from the south of France to Palestine and back, he's seen all the great empires of his time, he's seen the control of the church in Italy, he's seen practical democracy at work in Greece, he has seen the grand empires of the Middle East, and he comes back to an impoverished England where you cannot as an individual look after yourself, and as he says in the movie, you know, surely these are God's gifts first before they're king's possessions, and his altruism comes out of him for sort of practical, simple reasons. And I thought, if that rebel leader was to rise, if there was going to be this Renaissance fighter, what is the end game of the pressure that he applies to a monarch? Is it, in fact, the Forest Charter and the Magna Carta? So that's basically the idea that we ran with.
I had no idea that Billy Bragg, who's been on the programme many times, I spoke to him, he's a fascinating guy. Who'd have thought that he'd be so involved in that kind of... It's a key linchpin moment of the movie.
Oh, it was like the epiphany. It was like the thing that I'd been imagining and hoping for was actually true. You know, and particularly it's called the Forest Charter, or the Charter of the Forest. How more closely associated with the idea of Robin Hood can you get?
Try your Ridley Scott question again.
I know. Mark,
when we met,
yes,
just give me a bit more context because I might remember the conversation.
Well, it was the first time we met.
He's got a quiff.
It was in a hotel in Leicester Square. You were over for the opening of Rumpa Stomper,
right.
And yeah, I had a quiff then.
Who are you working for?
For the New Musical Express back then.
Absolute. That interview, right? I didn't mind the interview, but the way that was printed, I read NME as a young teenager.
No, hold on.
You're
thinking of Gavin Martin's piece in the NME.
Well, that was Rumpa Stomper.
Yeah, no. Yeah, Gavin Martin did an interview with you for the NME. I was working at the NME, but I interviewed you for Radio 5 immediately before Gavin Martin. Gavin Martin, who is an Irish guy who looks nothing like me, and I know exactly the piece you're referring to,
right,
and I will pass on to him your best wishes.
Yeah, where the headline was something like, you know, racist crow or something.
Yeah, that
was
not me.
That was so uncool, man. To be on by the Bible of your youth. That was just so uncool.
But I know that it all came right because you had such a great experience with the Radio 5 interviewer beforehand, Russell. If you remember that, I was the other guy.
Nice one.
At this point, I'm imagining Mark running for all his life with Russell with a quiver full of arrows, and he pulls one out and he puts it in his bow.
Straight in the ass.
Exactly.
I always wanted to, you know, talk to the sub-editor or whoever did that, because, you know, that film, as powerful as it was and as scary as it might have been for people to see, made its points very clearly.
Well, Russell,
if you engage in that sort of behaviour, you're either dead or arrested by the end of the movie. It was very clear.
I would refer you to my review of that movie in Q magazine and indeed the interview in which you and I discussed the fact that you'd been stitched up by that paper.
Oh, really? Okay, yes. So, and that was in the Insider interview.
That was in Radio 5. Sorry, okay. Simon.
Anyway, tell us about
Ridley Scott.
I just wanted to emphasise, I'm just a normal person.
Let's try that Ridley Scott question again.
Yeah, so tell us about working with Ridley Scott again, Russell.
Ridley Scott.
It's not a great question anyway, is it?
Yeah, well, it was kind of an empty question, so I'll just manufacture the colour.
Shall I just leave? Because obviously, I mean, this is just
Russell's
getting worse.
Come round to your house.
No. The funny thing about the way that I'm portrayed in the media here is that, you know, just hard man sort of... Let's focus on this for a second. You know, I'm into poetry, I write songs, and I wear makeup for a living.
Excellent.
This is not the habits and behaviour of a hard man. Anyway, so Ridley Scott, one of the grandest visual artists of our time. We suit each other because, though from the outside people might think that we are, you know, at loggerheads or whatever, we're just discussing something, and we both know that the end result of those discussions is a solution, and we both know that making a movie is all about problem solving, and there's a hundred to solve a day, and that's what we get about doing. You know, I find him to be just the most spectacular intellect to work with, because I know you don't listen to the tone of somebody's voice, you listen to the words that they're saying. And, you know, something might be annoying him because he's got 10,000 moving parts to deal with and everything, and I don't let, you know, that annoyance become the principal part of the conversation. I just listen to what he's actually needing, for, you know, and then try and help him find the solution. You know, when we work together, he gives me a lot of responsibility, and I appreciate that because, quite frankly, just learning my own dialogue and turning up and doing that is kind of boring. It's not a fulfilling job in many ways that way. So I like to be involved in all aspects of it, and on this film, for the first time officially, I'm actually a producer, but it didn't change my job. It's the same way that I've approached all the films I've done. But look, you know, he's a national treasure, Ridley Scott, for this country. I think he you know, the changes that he's made in the way people make films of scale, you know, the visual imagery that he's put in the mind of a particular generation, you know, whether it's the creature coming out of the person's chest in Alien, whether it's the world that he created in Blade Runner, whether it's the first true sort of post-feminist hero movie with Thelma and Louise, whether it's the way that he tied CGI into a human narrative in Gladiator, so to increase the scale without you seeing the strings, you know. He's an amazing fellow, he's an amazing filmmaker, and I'm in a really privileged position that he likes to work with me.
Well, we appreciate you being on the phone, being on the program, Russell. Thank you very much indeed. And great to go and see a movie. One of the great enjoyable things was to see a movie where the real baddies, the real bad characters are French. And that was quite a luxury for us.
Yeah, and we were opening Cannes, and Ridley's scratching his head going, did they not see the movie?
Russell Crowe, even Ridley Scott speaks like the Artful Dodger. I'm pleased by that. It's not just me.
Well, everybody in this country speaks like the Artful Dodger in one way or the other.
Russell, thanks very much for your time, sir.
All right, mate. Have fun.
Thank you.
See you, boys.
Have fun. When you go home tonight, that shadowy figure hiding in the bushes is going to be a man with a quiver of arrows.
We should say that what happened was we came out of that interview and Robin, our good producer, went, good interview. And there's a pause. He went, not for you, Mark, obviously.
Yeah. That's very true. So clearly he had been waiting to say that piece about the way the enemy had reported his film all these years.
But can I, at this point in that case, give it... What we did afterwards was I rang Gavin Martin. We tracked Gavin Martin down just because I'd said off the top of my head... I mean, it was really stupid because I'd completely forgotten about the enemy thing. And actually, I did interview him for Radio 5 and I did remember I was working with the enemy at the same time, but I just, you know, boom, walked into the open door of this by saying that enemy... So we got in touch with Gavin Martin and said, do you remember doing this interview? And Gavin said, yeah, of course I remember it. And I said, you know, he's still cross about it. And Gavin went, no. Really? That's when we were going to get Gavin on the programme now, but he's off in some... He's a very, very sort of fated film journalist, so he's off doing something else. But he sends his best regards and says that he's thrilled.
You kind of understand if you're written up as being a...
Well, the whole thing with Rumpelstiltskin, I don't know how many people actually saw Rumpelstiltskin, is it's a film about skinheads and, you know, fascist skinheads, in which Russell Crowe plays one of the two central characters. I liked the film. I reviewed it for Q magazine and I did interview him for Radio 5. It was picketed when it premiered at the Prince Charles Theatre by not the Anti-Nazi League, Anti-Fascist Action. I have subsequently been told that apparently the picket was, shall we say, not entirely unhelped by people attempting to publicise them. So the whole thing was a very complicated situation. Gavin didn't like it at all, or I think the enemy particularly didn't like it. I did like it. At the time, it was a divisive issue. But it was one of the, with of all the things to get into trouble with Russell Crowe. And clearly, he didn't believe for 1 minute that I wasn't the guy that wrote that article. Clearly, as far as he's concerned, it is me.
So we did that interview last week, and because this Billy Bragg connection was news to us, as indeed the Forrester's Charter is news to most people, we're going to be speaking to Billy Bragg in a few minutes' time just to fill in a few of those blanks. So more movie conversations to come, more with Billy Bragg, and reviews of, just remind us, the couple of big movies coming up.
Nightmare on Elm Street, the remake, the Black Backup Plan, Jennifer Lopez movie.
Okay, that's fine.
Stop now then.
Absolutely.
Did you beat up Mark Day?
We are discussing movies today because on a fairly reasonable assumption that tomorrow afternoon there'll be quite
some
a lot
other
of
stuff,
election bits and
news
pieces to clear up. So before the news, we were talking to Russell Crowe about the new Robin Hood movie. In the course of that, he explained that one of the key bits...
The key bit?
The Charter of the Forest, the Forester's Charter, came about because he had a conversation with Billy Bragg. As you heard, that was news to us. Billy's on the phone. Hello, Billy.
Hi, Simon. How are you, mate?
Good, thank you. Did you hear what Russell was saying there?
No, I missed the start of the interview, but I'm assuming he's talking about the Forest Charter that came out with Magna Carta and the influence that that had on the film. I haven't managed to see the film either.
Right, we started talking about Magna Carta, which is a plot point in the film, and then I mentioned about the Forester's Charter, and he said the whole Forester's Charter line came out of a conversation that he had with you. So how did that conversation go? Why were you talking to Russell Crowe?
Well, Russell Crowe is a Billy Bragg fan, and when I'm in Australia, he sometimes calls me up and comes to the shows, or if he's in London, he gives me a ring and we go out and have a chat. And I think I've been at an awards dinner and giving him an award. I think it might have been around that time that this conversation came up, and we were talking about Robin Hood, and we were talking about the Magna Carta thing, because I did a lot of this, went to a lot of this stuff when I wrote The Progressive Patriot. You know, talking about rights and Englishness and all that kind of stuff. So I just said to him, are you aware of the Forest Charter, which came out at the same time as the Magna Carta? And instead of being for the lords, for the knights, this was for the people, you know, the common people, and the rights that they had in the forest. And because at the time, you know, forest was considered common land. And although the Normans had closed a lot of that off, particularly under King John, there'd been a lot of misuse of very, very old rights for people in the forests, and they demanded a charter that laid down the rights for them to be able to do the things they needed to do to live, you know, to collect firewood, to feed their animals, you know, these kind of ideas.
It dates from 1217. I've got a copy of it here.
Did the BBC keep one, do they, just in case they have to...
We've got the original.
Copy, isn't it, Simon? You keep one yourself.
It's the original. I mean, there's some interesting stuff in there, like any archbishop, bishop, earl or baron who crosses our forest may take one or two beasts by view of the forester, if he is present. If not, let a horn be blown, so that this hunting may not appear to be carried on furtively. So there's lots of stuff which kind of...
There's Turbary. You can do Turbary in there. Do you know about Turbary?
Explain.
Turbary, cutting turf for fuels. There's pannage, and there's scrotage in there as well.
Can I? Yes.
Do you want to know what that is, scrotage?
Yes, go on.
If you have to wear a codpiece over your tights and not under them.
That's actually in...
That is actually what it means,
the
then.
The Charter of the Forest, is it?
It's in Latin. You have to look very closely in. A lot of it's still in the original French, the original demotic French. He was very taken with it. I mean, I think he was looking for something more than the men in tights in his idea of Robin Hood. And we were talking about, you know, the what went down, or, you know, the civil war really, that went on with regard to John and the barons, and how it came apart, and how it was put back together again by his successor, Henry, John's successor, Henry. And in the course of that, I was talking to him about the Forest Charter. I brought up the subject and suggested he went to the British Library and checked it out, because they had just had an exhibition on there, which I think was called Taking Liberties, which actually had in there, you know, an original Magna Carta and a lot of other important documents, the settlement of the Glorious Revolution. But it also had a copy of the Forest Charter there, which is where I'd seen it.
Then, bearing that in mind, Billy, it's quite interesting that so few people, I include myself in this, because when it comes up in the film, I thought, well, maybe they've just invented that. You know, I certainly haven't heard of it before. That, given that it has this importance, that it really isn't taught and no one really knows about the Charter of the Forest.
Well, Well, I mean, I think it's because, you know, I mean, really, we're talking about the common land being absolutely crucial to ordinary people's lives. You know, you couldn't just pop down to the shops in those days. You had to have your own cow if you wanted milk. You had to have your own sheep. You had to have your own pigs if you wanted bacon. So this was really crucial. And there's a whole slew of our history that isn't taught, which is about the enclosures. How, from the Norman period through the Plantagenets right up to the Tudor period, people in England were pushed off the common land in much in the way of the Highland clearances, really. Similar sort of thing, particularly during the Tudor times, people were pushed off common land and that land was given over to sheep. Whole areas were depopulated. And the thing is, because it didn't all happen in one event, because it did not, like the Highland clearances, something that was focused and in revenge for a particular act, because it happened over a few hundred years, people don't really talk about it. But the enclosures, the English enclosures, was a huge land robbery by the aristocracy. You know, that's why a lot of people, the landowners, particularly if you go around the West End of London, all have very French Norman names.
So this then really is a direct connection from this time, whether Robin Hood existed or not, but from this story, right the way up to the English Revolution and the Levellers and the idea of England being a Commonwealth and all that.
Yeah, particularly for the Levellers and the during the English Revolution, because they had during the English Revolution, it was hard for them to articulate what it was that they wanted. They didn't have, Thomas Paine hadn't written The Rights of Man, so they didn't have that idea of individual liberty. Karl Marx hadn't written anything about communism, so a lot of them used the Bible, but also they were campaigning against something that they referred to as the Norman yoke, which was the idea that the Norman aristocracy had come in and robbed the land from the ordinary English people. It's questionable historically whether or not that stands up, but that idea that they had of, you know, knights, Norman knights taking the land is the story that's played out in Robin Hood. And if Robin Hood was anybody, and whether he existed or not doesn't really matter, he was that person in the greenwood, in the forest, the common man, the ordinary person trying to, you know, make a living for himself and his family, who was constantly trying to stay one step ahead of the sheriff, the Norman sheriff and his men. And I think in the film, I think Russell Crowe picks up very, very strongly on that.
Billy, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for explaining your side of the Robin Hood film. I think you'll enjoy it, sir.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. Nice to speak to you guys.
Billy, thanks very much indeed. That's Billy Bragg talking about some ancient politics, which you can talk about.
Oh, that's all right, is it? Okay.
I suppose the current politics, which is off the agenda just for today. Billy Bragg explaining about the Charter of the Forest, and before that, Russell Crowe explaining exactly why he was speaking to Billy Bragg. Sean in Canterbury, the only one thing wrong with that Russell Crowe interview, it wasn't long enough. What a bloke. I could have listened to him for a lot longer. Me too, though. I think Mark, he was quite happy for it to finish when it did.
Item 6 in the Charter of the Forest: no swain mote shall henceforth be held in our kingdom oftener than 3 times a year.
I think that's quite right. Swain mote being a
Did
kind
you vote
of a,
for that?
For a swain mote. A swain mote is like a kind of a forest court. That's what it was.
But only 3 times a year.
Yeah.
No oftener than that.
Put that in your manifesto and smoke it.
Dear
Robin and Marion, my brother-in-law made the furniture for Robin Hood, so we are looking forward to seeing the movie, although I have a feeling that my wife may spend the whole time telling everyone and anyone about her talented brother. Kate Blanchett liked the bed so much she took it home after filming.
Really?
Wow.
Excellent.
You would think the amount of money that would, you know, it would cost to actually transport a large bed from wherever to somewhere else is going to be, you know, you can have your own one erected wherever you want it to be. But anyway, Kate Blanchett liked it so much she took it home.
Did I ever tell you about the time I was in Owen Roisman's house and I said, why does the rug on this floor look oddly familiar? And he said, because it is the rug from the floor of The Exorcist. And it was, because when they finish films, they have to do something with the furniture, so people often take them away as souvenir. Probably not now anymore, but that's what they used to do.
Robin Bromley, Dear Hung and Parliament, remembered to tune in on Thursday this week so as not to miss my fill of wittertainment. I may have managed to get the live streaming working, so I have full-on Kermode sound vision. But what is visible over Mark's shoulder through the glass? It looks like someone in a tux with their bow tie undone.
That's David.
Are your production staff dressing up for a special occasion? It's the aforementioned David who just likes to dress
up. It's the old-style BBC. You know, in the BBC used to be that everyone was in tailcoats and, you know, in top hats. And have you seen that film, Death at Broadcasting House? When it's brilliant, the guy turns up at the BBC and he says, hello, I've come to broadcast on the Light Programme. And the man says, I shall take you to the studio. Would you like a cigarette and a martini? Certainly, sir. And that's how they behave.
Does he die?
Well, somebody
what,
they,
with the
they,
title
they,
and all
they die no well he doesn't die that, not that particular guy, he's suspected of being the murderer, but it's whilst recording a play somebody dies.
Dermot in Dublin says, turning up the bass on my speakers while Russell Crowe speaks talking, is an experience, to say the least. He has inbuilt bass. More bass than Bob Harris, that man. Right, so reviews to start. We'll do a top 10 countdown in just a moment. Have you seen Dear John yet?
No, three things in the top 10 I haven't seen this week. Can I tell you in advance?
It's getting worse.
I know, I'm just slacking. Houseful, which is a Bollywood movie, which I don't think was press screened. The Ghost, which I still haven't because I haven't. And Dear John, which I still haven't because I haven't, because there's so much out this week that I've been catching up with. So either of those, any of those three.
Pathetic excuse. So if there's a one sentence review to come for any of those three, remind us of the three again.
Houseful, Dear John, and The Ghost.
One sentence is all we need. You can follow us at Wittertainment, by the way. If you go to Twitter or you go to the Five Live website, you can follow us from there. At Wittertainment is what you need.
May I say one other thing?
All updates come from me and not from Mark, who can hardly be bothered.
Subject of your enjoyment of me getting beaten up by Russell Crowe. If I am going to get mistaken for anybody, I would be very happy and proud to be mistaken for Gavin Martin, because I should say that not only was Gavin a fantastic editor to work for at The Enemy and a very, very good writer, which he still remains, he was one of the very early people who didn't show me the door when I turned up saying, I'd like to write for you. So I owe him very much. So I'm very honoured to be mistaken for Gavin Martin.
So who takes the rap for misrepresenting the film?
Who takes the rap for misrepresenting? Well, I mean, we have a difference of opinion about that film. I mean, I like that film. Gavin didn't like it. But that's you know, there is much to be said on both sides.
You were, a while back, because right about 2:15, a lady listener was asking for a definitive list.
A lady listener?
A lady listener, Mrs. Listener, woman listener. Listener who's a woman, who wanted a definitive list of British films so that she could argue with her flatmate.
Sure.
Say, look, if you hate all British films, you're just a fool.
And off the top of my head,
you came
up with
a list.
Pretty
anyway,
good.
Let's just... Russ says you didn't mention Local Hero.
Did I not say Local Hero? So. Sorry, it went through my head. I said it internally.
That was really useful then. Jack says, I watched The Draftsman's Contract the other day. That was brilliant. That's add good. That to the list. Nick in Leicester. Can't believe you left out the works of Shane Meadows and Nick Brumfield in your rundown.
It was off the top of
British
my head.
Filmmaking. Chaz, surely The Lavender Hill Mob and Stranger on a Train must be the best British films ever. And
Doctor Strange, love all of Stanley Kubrick's work after Clockwork Orange.
Box office top 10. Let me put those over there. Houseful is at 10, which we already know.
I don't know.
Well, could you go and see it?
I will do, yes, but I don't believe there was a national press show, but I will go and see it when I've catched up with the other stuff that I missed out on, what with being off for a week and now running to catch up ever since.
Number 9 is Nanny McPhee and the Big Bang. Richard, on this email, says, took the whole family to see Nanny McPhee the other week, ages 4, 5 and 9. Unanimous approval.
Good.
All round.
Loved it.
He says, also, just to email after listening to Dr. K's Napoleon Dynamite impersonation last week, what can I say? I was actually quite impressed with
that. Did I do Napoleon Dynamite?
It skipped my mind. But
I did. I did the thing about... That was somebody else tweeted about it. I couldn't figure out what... They said that I liked the new... I couldn't figure out what impression it was. It was the Sweet Jumps thing. Yeah, OK, fine, good.
Kick-Ass at 8.
Which I still like very much. And funnily enough, it's interesting how now that the initial flurry of outrage has completely died down, it's almost like that stuff has been... totally forgotten about. It really was a flash in the pan. The day that it opened, it was like, oh, it's bad and this, that and the other, and it just went like nothing, and now it's just settled down to be a sort of successful movie and nobody is talking about that anymore, which demonstrates, I think, quite, you know, categorically, that it was only ever a press story. Nobody really believed that the film was pernicious and evil and any of those things.
The Ghost is at 7. Couple of one-liners here. Mike Banks says...
Floyd and Boyd liked it, apparently.
A film that Alfred Hitchcock would have made, only he'd have made it a lot better. William Leeds, a terrific Hitchcockian thriller with Pierce Brosnan's finest performance in years.
You see, that's why I want to go and see it, because I'm more interested in Pierce Brosnan than I am in Roman Polanski, I have to say.
Mike also adds, did you know Alfred Hitchcock invented the jockstrap? That can't be.
No. Can it? Alfred Hitchcock invented the jockstrap.
Oh, I've just worked it out. It's a joke.
Go on.
There you go. I think. Well, we'll sit here while you work that one out.
No.
The clue's in his surname.
Oh, I see. Fine, very good.
There you go.
I can't believe you.
I'm slow. You're slower.
I'm slower. Dumb and dumber.
Indeed.
Okay.
Got there before anyone else did. Dear John is at 6. This from Huru.
What?
It's Carol in Sydney. Dear John, the trailer was bad enough, but the movie was a sucky, sickly, pathetic rom-com. nowhere in the calibre of The Notebook, which I first saw on a flight from Auckland to Sydney and cried buckets sitting next to a beefy tattooed bloke as I tried not to bawl my eyes out. Oh. So they're the stuff that you haven't seen. Clash of the Titans at 5. Titans will clash.
And they will do it in both 3D and 2D. If you see it in 2D, that's the way the film was shot. That's the much better way of seeing it. It's still rubbish.
The Last Song is at 4.
Which, you know, people keep attributing the Smiley Virus gag to me. It wasn't
Stephen
me.
Fry.
It was Stephen Fry. I don't know whether Stephen Fry made it up, because I think Stephen Fry... Didn't he say, what do they call a Smiley Virus? All the things that are wrong with it... I actually responded to it, and I did have a little bit of a sniffle, and largely because I think Greg Kinnear is just a convincing actor. I mean, it's not terrible. I mean, it's not any good, obviously, and it's completely saccharine and schmaltzy and all the rest of it, and totally manipulative. But you know what? It kind of worked.
Date Night is at 3,
which, you know, as I said, at £26, I felt severely underchuckled. The thing with Date Night is that there is a nice relationship in it at the centre of it between Steve Carell and Tina Fey. The problem with it is that because it, the story is that they go out on a date night and then it turns into this other thing, and it becomes either Into the Night, the John Landis film, or After Hours, the Martin Scorsese film, both of which are superior. It ends up chasing its tail with this kind of crime plot, which isn't very interesting and isn't very well done. And then there's a completely boring and gratuitous car chase in the middle of it. And you think, actually, all I want is those two characters sitting opposite each other in a restaurant, having the funny conversation that they have about the fact that they've been married for so long that their life has become strangely formulaic. That stuff's all funny. So my disappointment was largely that I didn't get more of that. What I got was all the other stuff.
New entry at number one, the UK's number one movie.
No, number two.
Oh, yes, at number two, How to Train Your Dragon. Beg your pardon, number two, How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah, How to Train Your Dragon, which I like, and as we've said before, apparently nothing like the book, which I still haven't read, but I did like it, and funnily enough, it stuck with me. I keep thinking about little moments from it which were funny and quirky, and it's not quite up there with Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, but it is in the same league of odd and quirky, and certainly something which you'll enjoy as much as the kids will enjoy. Doesn't need to be seen in 3D, perfectly fine in 2D.
Iron Man 2 is at number one. Now, some correspondence here. Lan Tracy. Great name. S&M, long-time listener, first-time correspondent. Love the show, Steve. I write today to object to some of the good doctor's criticisms of Iron Man 2.
Okay.
His ignorance of the backstory in Iron Man should not reflect on the film. Marvel, as a company, are building up to a combined movie called The Avengers, and this is why they are weaving these different story strands into their movies and why there are many characters coming in and out of the movie. Also, although this may not be your intellectual cup of tea, surely the good doctor should appreciate that the robots hitting each other is done very well, and the CGI is very believable, and this should therefore be taken into account when critiquing the movie. I happen to agree it's over the top at times, but still done creatively.
Didn't I, broadly speaking, think the movie was good? I mean, didn't I, broadly speaking, enjoy it, saying that my interest went down when the robots were hitting each other, although I think I said that was well done, saying that the stuff between Robert Downey Jr. and was funny, and saying that although it is messy, and it is messy, and it is overlong, and it is overlong, and people like Scarlett Johansson turn up to do nothing other than be Scarlett Johansson for a brief moment, and Sam Jackson comes in to say, hello, I am Sam Jackson, obviously I will be appearing in a future movie, that doesn't mean that as far as the form of the film itself is concerned, that's not a blip. I still did enjoy it, and I would refer you, incidentally, to the straightened out and broken backed structured versions of The Godfather Part 2, right? Which is backstory and front story put together in a, you know, broken back form, which they then straightened out for that television version, and the straightened out version wasn't any good. It is possible to have elements of a story that don't necessarily work there and then that are still artfully put together. I mean, Iron Man 2 is a lot of things, but it ain't Godfather Part 2. That's how you do disparate elements, making brief appearances because they have future relevance, without necessarily going, oh, Scarlett Johansson's on screen now for a couple
big,
of minutes.
Big flappy hand performance going on here to be enjoyed.
You know,
by
the reason you have to say streaming. Johansson is because that's how she says it.
I'm aware of that.
Although, as my very good friend Nigel Floyd says it, just because she doesn't know how to pronounce her own name doesn't mean we don't.
Oliver says, this is Oliver in County Clare, last weekend my best friend, who's a huge Iron Man and, sorry to say, this Transformers fan, went to see Iron Man 2. Mm-hmm. He admitted that Transformers wasn't great, but
yes,
really has liked the Iron Man films,
yeah,
being generally a fan of explosions and stuff. So what I mean to ask is, Mark's context of the review, is it a bit misplaced? Perhaps teenage guys who grew up with the comic books and the animated series and who, quite frankly, don't pay much attention to plot and dialogue, and the rest still really enjoy the film. I suspect they're the target audience for
such a film. If you don't pay much attention to the comic dialogue in Iron Man 2, you are basically missing the best part of the film. And I guarantee you that the people that made it think that as well.
Josiah Ripley, just on Iron Man 2, saw it last night, did exactly what it said on the iron.
Yeah.
Says Josiah, I apologise. I wondered during the final battle how many other Ghostbusters fans couldn't resist shouting, Egon, you said crossing the streams was bad. Dear Doctor and Who, am I the only person who noticed that Robert Downey Jr. was wearing platform shoes during Iron Man 2?
He's not a tall man, is he? He's not a tall man.
This from Neil in Lancashire. See if you can work out the film.
Cool.
A dozen chaps, not best pleased.
Dirty Dozen.
Well, actually...
Oh, no, 12 Angry Men. 12 Angry Men,
12
sorry.
12 Angry Men is what it is. And this from Kathy in Belfast. Enjoyed a brief conversation with Mark during his visit to Belfast on Saturday. Flogging his book, doubtless. Is that what it was? That's me adding that bit.
Was I flogging my book?
Is that
book?
What you were doing?
Yes, I was probably flogging my book. It was in between. I was flogging my band before and then flogging the book in between.
I informed him of my theory that,
your tweet.
That Jason Isaacs displays an astonishing resemblance to Bono when he first appears in Green Zone.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. Somebody said this. Well, obviously this...
It was him. Mark laughed and looked at me as if I was a little peculiar. He was, however, most polite and said he'd take this observation into account when next watching the movie or indeed when next talking to Jason.
Yeah, he
hello
said,
to Jason.
Have you noticed when he comes out of the helicopter, Jason Isaacs looks like Bono? And I said, I hadn't noticed that. I thought, you know, I was thinking more Village People, but apparently he looks like Bono.
And on the subject of senior screenings, just before we do a little bit of Nightmare on Elm Street, this from Sue in Aylesbury. I am currently between jobs. We were talking about senior screenings earlier, where cinemas get to patronise the people who come along. Come along for a tea and a biscuit for half a crown.
Enjoy it. Blame it on the bellboys on.
I go to senior screenings on Wednesday mornings at my local cinema. Last week, saw Nowhere Boy, got a cuppa and a biscuit for £3.50. My friends think this is quite naughty, as I'm actually 15 years off getting my bus pass, but as long as they don't card, I'm good. The screenings are very popular and surprisingly quiet. So now we get people sneaking in.
Oh, I'd love that.
They're
That's
sneaking
great.
Into movies that they're actually... still too young to see. They might be 50, but they're still sneaking in.
But the question is, are the older audiences silent, which is what I would really like, because obviously younger audiences just talk the whole time. Are the older audiences silent, or do they...
fall asleep?
Or do they go, what? What did he say? Who's that? Is that Bonio? Is it getting out? He's from the helicopter. Is you too, Imi? Where is he?
Danny Dyer?
Yeah, Danny Dyer! Danny Dyer!
Recently in the news, but enough of that. So let's move on and talk about new movies that are coming out, one of which will be a remake, always a bad start, of Nightmare on Elm Street.
This continues Michael Bay's mission to go through all the movies that, you know, you saw and were important, well, that I saw and were important to me at a certain age, and basically remake them. Go, all right, you take that movie and let's just, we'll turn everything up to 11, we'll lobotomise it, we'll take out all the interesting ideas, we'll put in more GRU, we will change the primary colour from whatever it was before to that kind of sickly green-brown, which now constitutes the default colour for all horror remakes. I mean, it's really, really bothering me. I mean, if I see another sickly green-brown horror movie, I am going to scream, and not in a good horror movie way. Anyway, the story, which I'm sure you will be familiar, is there are a group of school kids who are having dreams about being stalked in their nightmares by a character that we all now know as Freddy Krueger. Obviously, from their point of view, none of the Nightmare movies kind of existed before, because they don't go, oh, look, it's Robert Englund. Being stalked by Freddy Krueger, who is chasing them through their dreams, and the only way to be safe from him is not to fall asleep. Here's a clip.
Hey.
Wow, you look like you haven't...
Like I haven't slept in 3 days?
Listen, maybe you should talk to somebody.
I did. He thinks all my problems come from my past. We began going through my childhood, and... that's when they started.
When what started?
These nightmares.
Nightmares. So what, you can't sleep?
I can sleep. I just don't want to.
Okay, Dean, listen to me. They're just dreams. Okay, they're not real.
Well, the really important thing to say is this. In order to understand just why the new version of Nightmare on Elm Street is so rotten to the core, you have to understand what was important about the first Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, I know it sounds like an obvious gag, but the whole thing with Nightmare on Elm Street is whatever you do, don't fall asleep. I saw Nightmare on Elm Street in the cinema, turned up quite loud, and I have to say I did have a little snooze for, you know, a couple of minutes because it was that boring. Here's the problem. Wes Craven, who made the original, was always a filmmaker who was interested in substance and subtext, and he's actually an oddly moral filmmaker. And he'd started out making things like Last House on the Left, which is a real grindhouse movie. It's a very nasty piece of work, but I think is an important nasty piece of work. And then he graduated to Elm Street, which was a much more mainstream work, but all his stuff was political. I mean, the fact of the matter, as soon as you say Elm Street, you're immediately thinking Kennedy assassinations. You have the whole central idea of the first Nightmare on Elm Street is that the kids are in danger because they've been lied to by their parents, and what Freddy Krueger is to some extent is the manifestation of the sins of the fathers coming back to haunt the children. Also, if you know your Wes Craven history, Freddy Krueger, Krug Stilo is the lead criminal in Last House on the Left, and there is a through line in those characters, and it's important therefore to understand that. The other thing is, when Nightmare came out, I remember interviewing Brian Usner, who's a great interesting sort of, you know, fantasy horror filmmaker, and I interviewed him for a documentary I made for Channel 4 years and years ago, the first television program I ever made, called Fear in the Dark, which was directed by that guy Dominic Murphy, who went on to direct White Lightning recently, which I very much liked. And Brian Usner said that there was a watershed around the time of Nightmare on Elm Street, which was basically the birth of properly plastic reality in horror. He said because you'd had a whole load of special effects, things like polymethylcellulose and forms of very thin latex, which meant that you could do things on screen. This is not CGI, physical effects on screen that you couldn't do before. You could really stretch the boundary in what special effects guys could do. And consequently, what you were able to do was to make metaphors physical. And he talked about, you know, when you see that moment in the original Nightmare on Elm Street, for example, I think it's the original, the original one in which Heather Langenkamp, she's holding the phone and Freddy's voice comes on the phone and a tongue comes out of the end of the phone, and it's really, really peculiar. He said that this isn't gore, right? This is surrealism. This is proper surrealist cinema. And around the same time, you have David Cronenberg experimenting with the plastic realities, which leads him onto Naked Lunch. And it's about a moment in horror cinema which is really exciting and important, because it's about horror cinema throwing off the shackles of just being boring slasher movies, doing a whole lot of other interesting things. And then after that, we have Clive Barker doing Hellraiser and the reinvention of the genre. Very, very important time. Now what you get is Michael Bay's lot, you know, the destroyers of all creativity in cinema, the jackbooted bank managers who just come storming through in the pursuit of a quick buck, going, what was the whole thesis of Nightmare on Elm Street? Oh, he's got a big claw. He's got a big claw and he kills them. That's the thing, yeah, big claw kills them. In their dreams, yeah, they have to be asleep. Well, they'll be asleep. Maybe sometimes they'll be kind of awake, but they're sort of asleep. Anyway,
big maybe claw. Maybe they could be on the phone.
Big claw, on the phone. No, claw, like that. And it's just this horrible reductio ad absurdum of an idea, a film which wasn't about an idea, in which, although there was, you know, there is a degree of gore in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, and it's really scary. Did you see the first Nightmare on Elm Street when it first came out?
Not when it first came out. I interviewed Robert Englund shortly after.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah. Robert Englund is a lovely, really, really lovely man, really sweet, lovely guy, as all horror filmmakers inevitably turn out to be.
He was saying that he was worried about making any further films because of the new invention of video, and he'd been
really
upset that he was talking to, he was going on, I think it was a school tour of America or something, and so many 12 and 13 year olds had been to see this. He was thinking, I'm not sure I want to carry on doing this if 12-year-olds are going to see it. Anyway,
I do remember him saying that. That was a Radio 1 interview, wasn't it? But he was, intelligent guy and had some sense of, you know, the possible impact of his work. Creepiest scene in the first Nightmare on Elm Street is the bit when in the dream, Freddy is walking down a corridor, and suddenly there's a vision of him with these really long arms, and the arms are scraping against the side of the walls. And of course, it calls to mind things like Strule Peter and the Long-Legged Scissor Man, and all those, you know, and Belloc, and all those kind of great child fairy tales. That's, of course, what the original Freddy is. In this, there's none of that. There's none of the coherence. The backstory is completely messed up because they make a total pig's ear of Freddy commits this crime, but then the parents do something to him, and that's kind of what it's all about, because somehow it's not. It's about whether he did, and it's about the fact that it's the right... And they give you a whole bunch of backstory, which totally wrong, totally inappropriate, totally doesn't serve the story in any way whatsoever, just absolutely muddies the water of what the film is about. They lose all the proper surrealism. They restage a number of key moments in the original film, including the vortex of blood thing which happens in the first one, and yet somehow don't see it, don't manage to get it as some kind of fantastical creation, but just make it into, as I said, from red to this sort of insickly green brown thing. It's nastier in all the wrong ways. It's boring and louder in all the wrong ways. And you get this central performance in which has none of that thing which Robert Englund had, which was the sense that actually this is an archetypal bogeyman, or boogeyman, as they say in America. So when they say boogeyman here, I always think, you know, he's the boogeyman, he's the, but not that guy, but bogeyman, as we used to say. When you say bogeyman to Americans, they think you're talking about nose pickers. An archetypal boogeyman.
Interesting detour, that.
No, but it is an interesting detour, because you don't get either a bogeyman or a boogeyman. What you get is Jackie O'Haley just doing pizza face, now with CGI visuals, so bits of the face are hanging off, but not scary, not doing anything interesting verbally, not doing a scary voice, running around in a way that doesn't make any sense, that doesn't have any of the connection, the political connection, the thing about, you know, parent, despite the fact that they keep going on about the backstory, the whole sense of this is the sins of the parents and the children is just gone, because it just goes from one gory, boring, green-brown set piece to the next, and then it stops.
Is it boringer?
I'm not just saying this, but I did have a little nap at one point, because I just, you know,
in amongst the mayhem and the carnage.
In amongst the mayhem, because in the end, and I will say this, and I mean this properly, in the end, proper horror cinema is not about gore. Gore may be a function of it, but it's not about that. It's, you know, the thing that Clive Barker always said about it. It is about metaphors. It is about ideas. It is a cinema of ideas. Fantasy cinema is a cinema of ideas. If you reduce it to this, then you are sucking the life out of the body of horror cinema.
Go on, say reductio ad absurdum again.
No, I think once was enough.
Do you think?
I think descending
into... Was that a quote from the Forrester's Charter?
What, there will be no reductio... Yeah, I hated Nightmare on Elm Street, the remake. It was awful.
We started off by talking about Mark Strong because we had him say he's in absolutely everything. He also is a fantastic baddie in the new Robin Hood movie where all the bad guys...
are French.
Are French. That's why I knew that you know, there'd be some plus points. I mean, we'll review it.
Les hommes malades, ils sont français.
On via Twitter, the Rocking Vicar, who is always very interesting, says, when I was a lad, there was an action figure called Mark Strong with a real chopping arm.
Oh, you know what? Captain Mark Strong.
There you go.
He's right. He's right. There was a Captain Mark Strong. I don't remember the chopping arm, but isn't it?
What was he from?
Isn't he the other one in Major Matt Mason? Isn't it Major Matt Mason and Captain Mark Strong? Somebody who's the same age as me but has a better memory, please. Wasn't there Major Matt Mason, and he was a guy, and he was on a piece of string, and when you pulled the piece of string, his jetpack would take him up to wherever the piece of string was tied to, and I think it was Major Matt Mason and Captain Mark Strong.
Did Captain Mark Strong then use his chopping arm?
I don't remember the chopping arm, and I may be...
Did they work together? Were they against each other?
No, they were a team. And they had sort of hinged elbows and hands. They were like smaller action men. That's certainly what Major Matt Mason was, and I think that's where Captain Mark Strong came from, but I may be wrong.
It may will be that the Rocking Vicar has started something there. Okay, so Nightmare on Elm Street, you liked. What else is new?
The backup plan, which is the...
is that how you have to say it?
You
can
do
I
the,
have ticket,
the
two tickets,
plan.
Please,
for the backup plan. I was going to show you the poster, but I can't find it. So it's the J-Lo comeback movie. So here we go. Jennifer Lopez runs a pet shop, right? Yeah. Like Meg Ryan is a helicopter pilot and Keanu Reeves is a famous architect, yeah?
Or Buddha.
One of the two. I've forgotten that. Of course he plays Buddha, doesn't he? He sits under that
young
tree.
Young Buddha.
Yeah, okay. So that, Little Buddha, I think it was called, not Young Buddha. Then Jennifer Lopez can't get a man, right? In the same way that Sandra Bullock can't get a man in all those movies that we're... And Julia Roberts is, you know, reduced to being a hooker on Hollywood. But yeah, all those things, right, fine. So she goes to an artificial insemination clinic. No, she doesn't. Clearly, she, you know, this is screenwriters totally devoid of... What should we do? I know, what would be rom-com? Yeah, let's do that, fine. So then she gets into a taxi at the same time as another guy. You know, like happens in... One Fine Day with Michelle Pfeiffer and George Clooney or whoever it is. The thing that happens in movies all the time, but never, ever, ever happens in real life. Here's a clip.
Hello, my cab.
What, you own it?
No, but I'm about to rent it.
If you see someone hail a cab and the cab pulls up, you can't just jump in the cab and say it's yours.
I didn't see you.
I saw you see me.
Oh, sir? Sir, excuse me. Who saw you first?
Look, maybe you're not from around here, but there's a code, you know? There's certain rules that we try to follow.
You're fine. Forget it. I'll get out. But not because you're right, but because I'm in a terrific mood and you're ruining it.
That's Alex O'Loughlin, who apparently runs a cheese store. No, he doesn't. He's clearly a male model. It's like the whole movie is full of the... I'm going, no. And then they meet, and on the day of her, you know, the artificial thing, they fought. No, they don't. I'm going, no, no, none of this, none of the above. None of these things are true. She's not that person. He's not that person. She didn't do that. He didn't do that. None of this is happening. You're making it all up. I know
it's a film.
I know.
Of course they're making it up. They're
suspension
actors.
Of the willing suspension of disbelief, as Rowan Atkinson referred to it in whatever, in Blackadder. Okay, so at no point do I buy into any of this. The touchstone for how bad the backup plan, because then the story is she's now pregnant. She's now met the right guy. She's, you know, wouldn't you just know it? She just got pregnant just before she met the right guy who would have been the answer to all her dreams because she couldn't get a man. Yeah, right. And he couldn't, you know, and he runs a cheese store. So, and in fact, they're...
Can he not... because is that because of the cheese?
No, he can, but he can't... But he just runs a cheese store.
So the cheese store doesn't in any way interfere with...
Well, actually, the interesting thing is, right, this is one of the movie reviews itself, okay? Because, for example, there is a preponderance of cheese in the movie, okay? So he's a cheese store, he's a cheesecake or a beefcake. I think we've had that discussion before. And one of the big romantic encounter of the movie, right, is he invites her to his farm of cheese and they meet in a big cheese shed. And in the big cheese shed, they have...
Cheese?
No, what? No, they have sex in the, in, you know, amidst the cheese. And it's almost like the filmmakers are going, it's a bit cheesy, isn't it? Honestly, it's a bit cheesy. And then the other sort of running, if one believed...
Running cheese?
If one believed... It's very runny, sir. It's very, very runny, sir. If one believed that actually it wasn't just a terribly crass movie, that in fact it was the work of some postmodern art terrorist who was making the movie review itself, right? The other key element in it is that she has a cute handbag dog, right? Okay?
Sounds like a contradiction in terms.
Wait, yeah, exactly. Not just a cute handbag dog, a cute disabled handbag dog that carries its back half around on a trolley. Okay, now, turns out not really in any way spinally challenged dog. They've got a dog which is a quadruped and made it and put it in the dog wheelchair, you know, like...
Why? Why did they do that?
Because it's funny.
Right.
Yeah, no. So it's like the canine equivalent of Daniel Day-Lewis, right? And the gag is the dog in the thing falls over sometimes. And I'm sitting there going... Actually, that, and then there's a speech in which the dog becomes central, in which she explains that the reason she ended up running a pet shop was because she bought the dog, and the dog then had needs because it was sold to her by an evil inbreeders, and so she would fight back by taking over the pet shop, and then having a relationship with the man made of cheese.
Can you go back to the... When you
no,
said that the
I can't.
Dog had needs. What are you talking about? The dog had needs.
It needed to be tended to specially because it had a spinal problem that was due to the fact it was given that actually there was an evil puppy.
I thought that wasn't real.
No, it's not real. It's in the world of the fiction. And neither is the thing about the cabs. Neither is the fact that he works in the cheese shop. And then, right, she goes to a single mother's meeting, not noticing that in doing so, she's gone into the TARDIS and gone back in time to the 1970s, when all single mother's meetings are run by people who bang drums and are, you know, single, obese and mad and, you know, clearly believe that everybody should live on a yogurt farm, growing their own denim. And, I mean, it's and so then she comes out of that bit and then she goes on a date with this guy who's having financial problems but somehow manages to hire a private garden in the middle of the city where, in one of those classic moments, they turn up and there's candles everywhere that people have lit but nobody ever explained. And you're going, OK, this is so shoddy and poor and just badly... It's almost like the contempt for the audience is... It's like all the filmmakers are going... I don't care.
Graham Norton said he laughed all the way through it.
It's almost like the filmmakers are going, I just don't care. Then there's a humorous birth scene. Do you ever see 9 Months?
Oh, is
with
that
Hugh
the,
Grant?
Yeah, Hugh Grant. Yes. Is that the one where Robin Williams turns up at the end?
Oh, Robin, that's right. Robin Williams turns up as the comedy doctor.
Yes.
And wasn't that the movie that Hugh Grant was making on which he had his little...
His dalliance.
His indiscretion.
Yes.
Yes.
I think so, because he had needs.
Yeah, that's right, he did. Well, all the gags that are funny, or that could be funny, about the backup plan are in 9 months, but with Hugh Grant, and they're done funnier. So all the thing about, you know, hey, pregnancy, funny things happen to you, you know, blah, 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 all those things, yeah, ha, 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 they're all done before. All done before with Crucially. Hugh Grant, rather than with Jennifer Lopez, right? It was like, and... You know,
Could you explain, because that just sounded like you doing a duck impression.
The noise of me trying to eat my knuckles.
Right.
You know, as in knuckle-chewingly poor. And it was grisly and grotty and cheesy and you know, and all the time, all I can see while I'm watching is the filmmakers going, anyone care?
No.
Do you care?
No.
Crucially, do you care about
does
that?
Does it make you want to eat more cheese or less cheese?
I didn't want to eat any cheese. I felt that I'd been frottered with fromage from a great height. It was not so much an homage to 9 months as a fromage to 9 months.
Very good. We almost worked that one out.
We did.
Did it make you want to buy a cute handbag-sized dog with a wheel contraption?
No.
In the back.
Did it make me want to ever watch another Jennifer Lopez movie again? No. Did it make me think, oh, aren't movies about pregnancy funny? No. I just thought, actually, I quite like 9 months. I thought 9 months was quite good. Oh, that's the other thing. Do you know what happens in these in real life? Okay, obviously, if you are suddenly going to be a father, you go to a play park where you automatically meet a humorous guy who will regale you with tales of father. That happens all the time. It happens all the time, apparently. So that's it. You get into the cab, it's Jennifer Lopez. You go to the park, the guy regales you with tales. You walk down the street, somebody's lit all the candles. You run a cheese shop and she runs a pet shop and the dog is funny. And all I could think about with the dog was, how and when does it poo?
Why would you be interested in that?
Because...
Presumably it just can do it anyhow it likes and just move
faster. Semi-ambulant toiletry, that's all I'm saying.
It just spreads over a greater distance.
No, no, it doesn't. It goes in the little truck that it's pulling along behind it.
Well, you say you've answered your own question. So not much of a question, then, if you've answered it.
I imagine...
shoot your pen at me.
Just explodes.
So, meantime...
It explodes with anger.
Meantime...
It's not good.
I have a Mark Strong figure, says John, with a chopping arm.
Came with a
fake piece of wood that breaks in half karate style. And there it is. We've got photographs here of...
That's not Major Matt Mason. That is somebody else.
No, so it's not Major Matt Mason. It's Mark Strong.
No, in that case, but it is Mattel who did do Major Matt Mason. So tell me, who was the guy who was Major Matt Mason's sidekick? Major Matt Mason was red. No, not you. The listeners. You know, people listen... On the radio.
I think they've long gone. We've got outfits for Mark Strong.
Got three more movies to do if you've got
skiing outfits, frogman outfits, a warm-up outfit, cowboy outfits, a soccer outfit, Champions League. How about that? Karate outfit, commando outfit. You can get Mark Strong in all positions. And it is from Mattel. Thank you very much indeed for all the people who were mentioning that. So, that's all sorted. Hey, what's next?
Furry Vengeance.
Huh? Furry Vengeance.
Russell Crowe's in that, obviously.
George
of the jungle.
He's back and he's very, very large in this particular film. What has he been eating?
He has been eating
Pasta Boy.
All the pies.
It's
Pasta Boy.
Yeah.
You never said that to Russell Crowe.
It's 3:30. Didn't need to.
Come over here.
He was so
Pasta angry Boy.
With you.
Thank you so much for this email. Major Matt Mason's mates were Sergeant Strong. So, there we go. Sergeant Strong, Lieutenant Jeff Long, and Doug Davis, brackets, civilian. So I wasn't completely imagining that there
so
was...
So he's completely different to Mark Strong.
To Mark Strong. Sergeant Strong. I said, wasn't it so... So there we go. Sergeant Strong, Lieutenant Jeff Long, and Doug Davis, brackets, civilian.
Because on this Mark Strong dossier, it's eyes hazel, hair brown, profession, crime fighter, cover, racing driver, special information, adaptable to disguises. sportsy, like karate expert. So that's clearly not a sergeant. He's not a sergeant.
No,
in any
no, no, no. They're a different one. They're both called Strong.
What are you going to do next?
Let's go. I want to zoom through to, because we've got four lines coming up. So, Furry Vengeance. Did you say you've seen this?
Yes. Fine. I went with Joe, my 10-year-old. We went to see, because nothing else. We'd seen everything else. So we went to see Furry Vengeance with George.
George of the jungle.
Watch out for that tree.
So the story. Do you want to do the story setup, or shall I do it?
No, you do it.
Okay.
It's your
job. So the story. Thank you. So the story is that Brendan Pies Fraser is
Pastor boy
is a nice one. Is a nice family man who has moved from the city to a little sort of forest enclave where he is living in a show home in order that he may oversee the development of a little nestle of houses to be built by a green company within this area. Little does he know that actually what he is a stooge for the company, which is really wants to decimate the entire forest and turn the whole thing into some sort of suburban horror. The animals get wise to what's happening and they decide to wreak furry vengeance.
All I am saying is I think you should take a day off and consult a professional. You're obviously going through something.
I can't do that. I can't afford to miss another meeting with Lyman. The guy's flying hundreds of miles out of his way just to see me.
Mr. Eco Developer is flying hundreds of miles out of his way in a private jet in order to have a meeting about eco development.
Right. Hey, that's funny. Look, honey, just because a crow kept me up all night's no reason to throw in the towel. It's going to take a lot more than that to keep Dan Sanders from building his utopia.
So the boss is played by Ken Jeong, who gets all the best laughs. He's quite funny, and I counted three or four, good chuckles when he was on screen. The rest of the time, despite the fact that it's, CGI animals fight back and do stuff and cover Brendan Fraser in, mud and stuff and water, and there's a certain amount of animal excretion jokes, and there's, sort of...
Lots of skunks,
lots of, musk and all that sort of stuff flying around. I did find it pretty pedestrian, and I went in really wanting to enjoy it, wanting to think, oh, good, early, good fun, kids movie, blah, 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 and I didn't enjoy it half as much as I should have, despite the fact that I like Brendan Fraser, despite the fact that I like the idea of, animals getting together and dropping things on evil developers. Ken Jeong, I did laugh at his stuff. The rest of it, here's the key to what was wrong with it. Did you say to the end?
Yes, of
course. Did you see the musical sequence at the end?
Yes.
At the end of the film, there's a musical sequence in which they play some song. Is it a popular song with young people? I didn't recognise it.
Me neither.
No, you too. Okay, fine. Because you're, 62 and I'm 58?
Something like that.
Fine. So they play a popular song with young people, and in which all the key members of the cast do a little bit of lip-syncing and dancing. When you run out of ideas in a film, get the cast to lip-sync and do a bit of dancing. And then there's a sequence of clips, not outtakes, in which they're doing this song, lip-syncing and dancing around, but you realise that they've done it all the way through the movie. There's the bit when she's wearing the skunk makeup, there's the bit when he's in such and such, and you realise that what looks like a totally throwaway gag has in fact been the comic bedrock throughout the production, and the gag, it's laboured, and there's a bit when it's Brooke Shields, there's a little moment of her doing a Blue Lagoon. In fact, I didn't even notice it was Brooke Shields until she comes on at the end dressed up as Brooke Shields out of Blue Lagoon. You go, oh, that's who it is, it's Brooke Shields out of Blue Lagoon. And in a way, in the same way that the dog was the touchstone for what everything was wrong with Backup Plan, the dance number, the song number, was exactly what's wrong with Furry Vengeance, which is that the gag's just very, very laboured and very, very not as funny as it should be. And actually, I was rather disappointed, which I went in with higher expectations.
So I went to see it with Joe's 10, and I think...
So target audience, therefore?
Well, no. See, that's the thing. I think target audience...
4.
5, 6-year-olds.
Okay.
7, you're on the edge. He declared it to be the worst film he has ever seen in
ever.
His life. In fact, he decided that very early.
And he saw Alvin and the Chipmunks 2 with me.
Yeah.
So did he think Alvin and the Chipmunks 2 was better?
No, No, clearly, if that's the worst film he's ever seen, everything else
is better.
Is going to be better than that. So I think 10-year-olds will sneer. And okay. They think, this is juvenile.
Yeah.
This is trivial.
But I don't mind juvenile, trivial, and for babies. Because the first Alvin and the Chipmunks was all those things, but it was quite funny. There's a quote from Brendan Fraser, who's an executive producer. He says, I was entrusted with the privilege of being an executive producer on this one. It allowed me to have a strong sense of collaboration with everyone involved in the process of putting together the picture from pre to post-production. What that means is, they went to Brendan Fraser and said, want to do a Cut the Animals movie? No. Brooke Shields is in it.
Really?
Be executive producer. Oh, all right then.
Pass me another bowl of pasta. Martin, on this, we're going to do some travel and then we get to Four Lions.
Yeah, okay. We need to do Hot Tub very quickly, but I do want to do Four Lions first. So, yeah, we'll do Four Lions first and we'll do Hot Tub at the end.
So, just what I just said then?
No, well, all right. Okay.
Martin say, I'm looking forward to Mark's Four Lions review. Chris Morris is without question a genius, and I'm hoping he is sufficiently encouraged by this film experience to press on and become a new shining light in English comedy filmmaking, unlike the deeply unfunny and mysteriously and profoundly overrated Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. I won't count Ricky Gervais because he's gone all Hollywood. So let's do
Four Lions
and then the Hot Tub film.
About which there has been, you know, a certain degree of controversy when it was revealed that what Chris Morris was working on. I mean, you obviously know who Chris Morris is, the guy from, you know, Day to Day. And I first knew his work when I was working at Radio 1. He was doing what was then Blue Jam, which I think then later on became Jam. And very interesting guy. Some of his comedy very, very funny. Some of it too edgy for some people. So it was revealed that he was doing a comedy about suicide bombers, and there was a certain amount of fuss in the press about this. So the story is there's a group of guys up in the north of England who have decided for completely bizarre reasons that obviously what they're going to do is become suicide bombers. And the group, it consists of one guy who's a kind of family man, one guy who's not the brightest, one guy who's a complete zealot. And the film essentially revolves around the central idea that just because they want to be suicide bombers doesn't mean they're not people as well, and also doesn't mean they're not Burks. Here's a clip.
Would you kill me then?
No, of course not. Come on.
I'd kill you, bro.
Would you?
Yeah.
Right, good. Because I would kill you, bro. Right? I'd kill you like that.
Flip your neck, man, would you?
Yeah, of course.
That's what I thought. I was joking a bit there, bro.
We're soldiers, bro. Right, look, whatever that's to do, you do the right thing. Right? You with me?
Yeah.
It's life, innit? It's just life. What is that? It's nothing. It's like being stuck in the queue all in towers. Do you want to be in the queues or do you want to be on the rides? You want to be on the rides, don't you? You want to be on Nemesis, on Oblivion.
Rubber Dinghy Rapids.
Yeah?
Yeah?
You with me?
Rubber Dinghy Rapids.
Yeah, Rubber Dinghy Rapids.
Now, in many ways, that's kind of pretty much the tone of the film. And once you've got past the sort of, you know, the shock of the initial subject matter, which I think kind of blew up pretty quickly, then that's the tone of the film. It's done in that very sort of low-key comedy style. Now, here's the thing to say about it. Firstly, it has clearly been researched very, very heavily. It seemed entirely from the point of view of those central characters. And you could criticise it on any level for being about a subject which the writer and the director don't understand. I mean, obviously, just the very idea of making a comedy about this subject is touchy itself. But clearly, Chris Morris and his co-writers have gone into great depth to find out about the area that they are writing about and making the film about. Essentially, what you get is this really bizarre thing in which there are some really, really funny gags. I mean, laugh-out-loud funny gags, some of them slapstick gags, some of them very black humour, sort of gallows humour gags when some of the, you know, the suicide bombers blow themselves up. Some very kind of scabrous lines, like, for example, the police saying, he said you shot the wrong person. Like, no, that must be the target. It must be a target because I've just shot it. Conversations about whether or not the honey monster is a bear. Ludicrous religious discussions, declaring war on mini baby Bell, all that sort of stuff. But at the centre of it, you do have a kind of, you know, a humanist drama about these characters. There are some. I mean, the funny thing about it was that it being a Chris Morris movie, and if you've seen the poster, all over the poster are quotes which say funny, and they also say how funny it is. And there are clearly things in it that are funny. There are, you know, I did laugh a few times in it. I have to say that the overwhelming thing for me was a sense of sadness and tragedy, and because obviously as it moves towards its climax, as it moves into, you know, a more and more difficult area, which is that they decide to go and attempt to bomb the London Marathon. Clearly, the subject matter itself is so clearly not funny in any way at all that it's unsurprising that a film about that should not be funny. I don't actually think that's a fault. I thought the film was very well made. I think that its intentions are, broadly speaking, honourable. I think that it's an intelligent drama. It's played, I mean, I have to say, very, very well played. And it does warp a knife edge, although it's far less. I mean, some of the comedy is quite broad. Some of it, as I said, is kind of, you know, slapstick knockabout stuff. But it's far less confrontational than perhaps you would expect if you're familiar with Chris Morris's other stuff in the past. I mean, some of the stuff he has done has been really, really in your face. It's not like that. Oddly enough, there's a kind of elegiac tone to it, which is, and I think this was my take on it. Although the film doesn't give you a load of backstory about the characters, it doesn't, you know, basically say they are like, they have these beliefs because they've been mistreated by society, because this, that, and the other. You are left to fill in the backstory for yourself. But if there is a message in the film, what I took away from it was that the real tragedy of it is that these people believe this complete nonsense. The idea of, you know, rubber dinghy rapids is basically why you do this. You're going to be fast-tracked to rubber dinghy rapids. Because they have been fed ideas that are poisonous. They've been been fed ideas that are wicked. They've been fed ideas that are wrong by people who, incidentally, are not the people who are then going on and committing crimes. There is a terrible sense of utter misguided tragedy at the back of all this. Now, how much that's in the movie, how much that's what I took away from it, how much, you know, I don't know. All I can say is that when I saw it, I didn't feel that it in any way trod on toes that it shouldn't tread on. I didn't think it was making light of a subject, which is tragic. I didn't think that what it was trying to do was to make us sympathise with people who are wicked. I thought that what it did was, in a strangely comedic, in the old sense comedic, not comedic like laugh out loud funny, although there are funny bits in it, gave you a portrait of something which was absolutely heaving with pathos, absolutely heaving with, you know, with oddly enough sadness. There's a very strange little moment in it in which one of the main character, who's pretty much the most intelligent of the bunch, is having a conversation with his kid in which he's trying to explain suicide bombing, but in relation to The Lion King. And it's full of pathos and sadness. And so what I took away from it was, I thought it was a well-made film. As I said, I thought it was, you know, I didn't think that it was offensive in any way. I thought that obviously it's a subject which will be very well. I know there's a long discussion this morning on Five Live about whether or not it's just too close to home to.
Well, it was a specific point which has been made by the father of one of the seven victims, yeah. And he said
problem. As far as I understand, you carry on.
Well, if it was a general satire about suicide bombers, okay, but it was too close to what actually happened. It was too close, too near the knuckle for as he saw it to be acceptable.
Well, I understand that, because, I mean, the fact of the matter is the comedy is not broad enough to make you think, oh, what you're watching is a knockabout comedy. Actually, if there is a triumph of the film in that, it is that it doesn't use comedy to distance itself from the appalling reality. I mean, I think that's, oddly enough, what I thought was brave about it, that it doesn't distance itself far enough for you to be able to go, OK, fine, well, this isn't related to a real thing. I mean, as you know, with Chris Morris, he's a comedian in inverted commas, but actually he tends to take things deadly seriously. I mean, I think there is a real serious purpose in what he does. And, you know, I know people have interpreted the movie as, you know, just because they're bombers doesn't mean they're not human. Just because they're monstrous doesn't mean that they are monsters. They are, in the end, people doing something which is hideous, but they're doing it for reasons which are, which are completely confounding. So that didn't bother me. I didn't laugh very much. I didn't find it very funny, although there are individual bits in it that I did find funny. But personally, I think the fact that it wasn't funny is kind of appropriate to the subject. I'm not saying there weren't laughs in it. And it was, one thing that was interesting, when I went in there, somebody introduced themselves to me who was a journalist who'd worked in the area of, specialised in this area, and had been one of the people to whom Chris Morris had talked. And, you know, he researched very hard. They were behind me and they were laughing in the obvious jokes. But I did get the sense that actually it's not. I know the poster says funny, funny, funny. It's actually not that funny, but I don't think that's a failing of the film. I was quite happy to have only laughed as much as I did. And certainly, as the drama moves towards its conclusion, the laughs become, you know, even less. But I thought that was I thought that was entirely appropriate. And Carlton the Lantern, I liked it. I thought it was a very very well-made film with, I thought, a degree of braveness which was unexpected, and a level of laughs which for me was appropriate, because it's just, in the end, not that funny.
So there's a hot tub.
Hot tub.
And it's a time machine.
It's hot tub time machine. So the story is John Cusack and some friends, one of whom has attempted to commit suicide at the beginning of the movie, go off to the place that they used to go in the 1980s, where they used to have wild, boysy times. Now they're just all washed-up blokes. They go there with a younger member. They get into a hot tub. The hot tub is a time machine. The time machine takes them back to 1986, and it's Back to the Future all over again. I was going to play you a clip, but I don't think we've got time. Here is what needs to be said about Hot Tub Time Machine. I went in really wanting to like it because it's Hot Tub Time Machine, in the same way as Teenage Nymphoid Barbarian in Dinosaur Hell, or, you know, Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers, they charge an arm and a leg. All those things. Surf Nazis Must Die.
The Rugsuckers from Mars.
Rugsuckers from Mars. What's the other one? Is the
Andrew Neil's favourite film.
Yes.
Or Andrew Knoll.
Andrew Knoll, yes. There's that movie by the Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Crazy Mixed Up Zombies. you know, I like the title, I like the idea, I like John Cusack, and there's this sort of very arch thing going on that John Cusack, who's an 80s icon, goes back to the 1980s and said, oh, I, you know, how much I hate the 1980s. They very rapidly discover that they have to relive all the things that they did before, otherwise the younger guy who is with them will not be born. And you go, okay, well, that's the Back to the Future plot. The Back to the Future plot is added to by the fact that Crispin Glover is the bellboy in the hotel, right? So it's funny because they refer to things like the Terminator. They say, oh, it's like that bit in Terminator when John Connor has to go back to save Sarah Connor in order to become, you know, the father and the grandfather and da da da. But nobody says, you know, actually the thing it's like is it's like Back to the Future. And what's peculiar is that that guy who's the bellboy, who's only got one arm, which is a David Lynch gag, which will be explained at the end of the movie, is the guy out of Back to the Future. So there's a certain amount of laughter in Hot Tub Time Machine, but nothing like enough when you consider that it's Hot Tub Time Machine. I mean, it's like if you're going to make Hot Tub Time Machine with John Cusack going back to the 1980s, you have to do more than essentially give us a cross between The Hangover, which I really didn't like at all, and Gross Point Blank, which I did like very much, and Back to the Future, which all these movies kind of aspire. I mean, one of the things that Hot Tub Time Machine did do is it did make me realise just how great Back to the Future is. I think a BFI Modern Classic has just come out about it, which I would like to read, but Back to the Future is a really very, very smart, I mean, really stands the test of time movie.
And first one, great. Second one,
all over the place. Third one, Castle Return. Yeah, exactly. And I think third one kind of pulls it all back together again. I mean, the one in the middle is the filling, so it's always difficult because it's the one that it doesn't have a beginning or an end. It just has a middle. Hot Tub Time Machine, I think five laughs. Five laughs. But not five laughs in the way of, you know, when I say with Cemetery Junction, I didn't laugh all the way through. Didn't mean it wasn't an interesting film. Certainly not in the way of Four Lions, which I didn't laugh that much, but I do think it's a very fine film. Not enough laughs to justify it being Hot Tub Time Machine, and far too close to being The Hangover, which, I'm sorry, is wretched.
Thomas Smith says, of course it's possible for comedies not to be funny, but this makes them bad films. If the good doctor disagrees, I've recently written a horror film which isn't scary and a thriller, and a thriller yeah, which isn't thrilling. Which would he like to read first?
Yeah, very good.
So as the music is playing, it's time for that selection.
Film of the week.
To make now. Would you like to choose your film of the week?
Four Lions.
Mark, thank you.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.